called a timberman. He uses a broadaxe. I got a broadaxe here. I'm going to show it to you.
Oh, have you? I'd love to see one of those.
Yeah. I'll show you something. And the augers, he used to make ox yokes with them. I got lots of stuff.
I'd love to see a broadaxe.
Yeah, I'm going to show it to you. Well, I got about $200 worth of tools or more than that.
Oh, you were going to tell me how you were born a socialist.
Well, born a socialist.
What influenced you that made you?
You know, father and mother were awfully strict, and we had no kids to play with. So everything, of course, we always invented something to do, you know. And the only plaything I ever had was a wooden horse that my father was. He carved out a wooden horse. We could stand him on the floor and play with him and call him our horse, you know, and that's all we knew about our horse was that wooden horse. We didn't know anything about anything. And so...
all you knew is what you saw.
That's all. And then we had an impression, you know. You'll have to remind me because my mind is slipping on some things, you know, now. But I said I'll sit down the way I do it. When I run a, some incident that I know thoroughly because it's in the back of your head and might not think of it, you know. Mm-hmm. But when I do that, he can make notes of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I started that when we came here 2 years ago. Well, I wrote some on the farm before I got here, but then I finished up here.
Mm-hmm.
And go back and then. I had to be reminded of some incident that happened that stood out. Father had all schooling he had 3 weeks. And my mother, all the schooling she had, she wasn't in school very much. It was very little.
She could
read tradition, but she couldn't write,
mm.
See? And if they write, she says, when she went to school, then they had a long bench. 10, 12 feet long and about 4 feet wide, you know, and low enough so the kids could stand around it, and then put sand in there, and they were writing in the sand so they could rub it out with their hands like that. Just imagine. That's the kind of school she had.
Mm.
And another thing, father, he just had 3 weeks of schooling, but he had an awful memory. He could remember songs, you know. He had a whole book of them, a song book. I don't know, I think my brother John got away with that because he liked to sing too. And Charlie, he was a good singer. I want Charlie, but that's long after. Well, anyway.
You remember any of those songs?
No, I don't remember. I never took any after the father stopped me from playing the violin. But then
he didn't think?
See,
thought it was sinful.
They were kind of religious, you know. He was on the Baptist order, but mother was on the Lutheran order.
Oh.
See, there was a little, but there was no friction between them. They both went to church.
What?
The Norwegians and Swedes here, they each had when they got started, they each had an assembly of their own. If a house burnt down, the first house I remember that burnt down was a fellow by the name of Harry Patterson. His house burnt down, and father went right to Brainerd and begged for clothing and money, and he was a good mechanic. Father is from a place in Sweden they call Dalarna. That's just like a Krobing County here, see. Dalarna. And mother, she was from another place called Värmland. And that was a county by itself, but they talked different. You see, they had no telephone, no telegraph or anything like that. You know, everything.
Mm.
So they were kind of isolated, you know, and they were terrible in some of their methods of getting along, especially the young people. Gustav Vasa, he wasn't a king. It was Carl the 12th. Well, that was way back before Gustav Vasa's time. But
okay.
They were the fight came on religion, Catholics and Protestants.
Oh.
But and they were strong on religion, you know, strong on religion, but their personal life was contradictory, you see, on lots of it. Mm-hmm. He didn't have no schooling, he was a young fellow. He came here in 1869, and it took him 29 days to come across the ocean. And they were all seasick, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I had a terrible time. And mother came, father came a little earlier than that, and then he didn't know mother. And they landed in Michigan. He was an iron miner. They landed in Michigan and got acquainted with my mother, you know, and they got married, and that's where I was born. I was born in Michigamme, Michigan, and I was baptized in the Methodist Church. When I was a kid, a little kid, I didn't know anything about it. But we couldn't tell a lie. See, if any one of us told a lie on the other one, we'd get whipped for it. Mm-hmm. See? They wanted the absolute truth, you know. And I grew up that way. And then I was the oldest in the family. See? And when they went out making in the wild meadows that was around, they'd take their take a couple of hay rakes, and father take the side and the whetstone, and they take the hay poles, had long poles to carry the hay on, and a couple of pitchforks and their lunch for the day. And then they put me in charge of the kids, and there were six of us, see? Six of us. And one was a baby. And I had to stay home and watch so that no harm came to them. And in protecting them, I had to protect myself. See?
Mm-hmm.
I remember one time one of the little tots, I think it was Mary, she ran out towards the cow barn, and she got inside the fence, and one of the heifers saw her, you know, and by golly, he made after her, and I made a beeline there to get the gate open and pull the kid in. We just barely got the kid out of there. She'd not. Well, just things like that, you mm-hmm. know. And Johnny was full of the dickens all the time. When we get into a fight, he was barefooted. We didn't have any shoes in the summertime. We was barefooted. And he'd knock me down on the floor. He was terribly strong. He'd knock me down on the floor and grab my foot and bite my toes, you know. Well, that's what he, see? Yeah, because he never had used any sense. When he bit, he really bit.
Oh.
See? I was scared of him. So, but I had to look out so that he didn't, nothing harmful happened. Morning. Just as soon as the sun was up, they started on their trip. They get up early in the morning. And go out to Section 15, way out on the other side of Ironton here, and from this place. And in those days, there was nothing cut here, nothing but Indian trails, you know. And stay all day.
Mm.
And when they come back, then they had all these extra chores to do, you know, milk the cows and straighten us kids up and get something to eat, you know. I remember when we moved into the log cabin, after what I told that in the story to him, into the log cabin, father made two wheels, double across the board like that, made it strong, took inch lumber, you know. And then he took, I don't know where in the Samuel he got it, but he got steel bands. He must have got it of an oil can or something, something that was tied in there. And straighten it out, you know, and they had to put it through the fire and straighten that out because there was a certain angle to it. And he put that all around to protect the wood, you see, and then put an axe in it, and then put a frame on top of it, and then a shaft like you have for a horse, and then a rope tied in the middle of it, and then to go over your shoulder like a harness, you know, and then to steer this wagon. And all that work was done just to haul the cook stove from the place there where we squatted up to this other place. And he mowed out a trail, took out the brush wide enough so they could go. And mother was pushing.
And he was pulling.
And pulled out, and no roads, you know. The bank on Rice Lake there, that was nothing but trees, you know, trees, heavy
things. Make a path for the wheels.
Yeah, make a path for the wheels. And when he come down to the creek, He chopped down a big basswood tree. It was about that big around. And he split it right in two, and it was lucky that it split straight, you know. Mm. Well, then in order to cross the creek, he put one for each wheel across the creek there, so he could get across the creek, you know, because the creek was deep, see? He laid it right on the back like that, and so the wheel pulled it over there. And while they was gone, let's see now, Charlie and Mary, they were born on this farm. So it was Victor and John. Not for a solitary one.
She just delivered them by herself.
Yeah.
Father helper?
Yeah, sure. I remember when he showed the we was getting out of our trundle bed. I never slept in. Oh yes, I slept in it once. I remember with Victor. But anyway, we had a high bed, you know, high bedpost, and then we had a trundle bed that you could shove under. See. But that wasn't shoved under our bed, that was shoved under father's and mother's bed, because that was higher. And we had a door in one end and a big window with 9 panes in it. They were 10 by 12 panes. And father made the frame and put in the glass, and it swung out. The log cabin was made out of logs, and it was moss in the cracks, you know. Driven in moss from both sides, inside and outside. And I know the first summer we didn't even have a floor in it. So mother said, now you have to sweep the floor, and we swept the floor. Any rubbish that lay in
the
ground.
Dirt floor.
Yeah, a dirt floor. But it was hard, you know, walk on all that. I swept everything clean. Then we had to go out in the brush, and we'd pick out the hazel brush. They had nice leaves on. And we'd rip or a basket full of leaves, you know, put in there. And then she go out in the swamp, way out, leave us, you know, up at the cabin, you know, anything could have happened to it. And pick moss in the swamp. And she come with a bag sack, mostly like a bran sack, you know, filled up, packed full of moss, you know, save up.
To put in the crack.
Yeah, put it in the crack, and then you had a tamper, you tamped it in with it. That's why I had more sympathy with mother than with dad. Yeah, I had more sympathy than I had before. No, I tell you. Come over here. Oh yeah,
that's awesome. No, I don't think he left anything. And she lived to be 82 after all that, huh?
Yeah.
Those women are really unsung heroes, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, of course they are.
That's right. Were you very close to your mother?
Oh, very close. I was the last one to kiss her. Nobody else did
it. And she must have been very close to you. You were kind of like her helper.
I stayed home till I was 34 years old. I never had any fun, but I had done a lot of thinking right there. Not only that, but everything concerning anything that happened. My mother left the old country, and she, her brothers wasn't educated either. And I knew when I was, I should have told you about how I became a socialist. That's more interesting. But you want that on the record? I really like coffee.
Well, that's right. I'm interested in women. I think I'd like to write a book about a woman like your mother. No, thank you.
Well, these are good.
I'll just have the coffee. I'd like to write a book about one of those women, you know. There hasn't been any really good story about them.
When it came right to brass tacks, I was for mother all the time. And when father sold the first 5 acres of land over there, he took it and went to Sweden, left us here.
Oh, he did?
Yeah, but he come back, you know, when the railroad come through here. I wrote him, I told him, I said, you better come home. And that railroad company offered him $1,700 for the right way, because they went through both two quarters, see?
You mean he had intended not to come back?
He was stubborn, you know, and he was sore, and of course he thought Mother was getting a little too old. That's all the darn trouble.
Well, I thought he was such a religious man.
as I tell you, it's nothing but bunk, you know. That's a fact.
You mean he left her with all these children?
Just left. Just took the $500 and left. Didn't leave us a darn thing.
Well, I'll be darn.
But he was good while we was growing up, that we never starved. But you had to give Mother credit for that, because he was a good cook. And we had no variety. I bet you'd be laid in that log cabin, the whole year. Never saw a cookie or a cake or anything like that. Everything. I remember the first meal. You ask any of the rest of them, they don't remember that. Father had hewed the logs, you know, so there's two flat sides. And when he came up there, he got a little clear and big enough so that he had a place for the log cabin. I can't understand how he ever got them logs together, and he was all alone doing it.
All by himself?
At one time he weighed 210 pounds, and it wasn't fat, but he was muscular, you know. He was a powerful built fella. And he took one of those half logs that he, when he's making the gables, before you got the gables up, the roof wasn't on. Yes, the roof was on, that's right, but it was from under the gables. And then he had two blocks about that long, you know, and he laid them crossways on the ground like that, and on one over here, and then he took another one and laid on top of it, a log that he had hewn. And Mother served us dinner. We had potatoes and milk gravy and bread and butter and milk, of course. We didn't have coffee even. And fried pork that was sliced, because we'd had pigs down there, so we had that. That was our dinner. First dinner on this place, 79 years ago.
And you remember it. Now, how in the world do you... Must have made a big impression on you.
Oh, it did.
But she could... But it was so good? I mean, it was so good? Is that what made you...
Well, we didn't know of anything else. Maybe if we... I'll tell you, the first time I went to Aiken. Grandpa and Casey, Father was trading there, and he always used to buy... 5, 6, 7 sacks of flour in the fall. Because there was no way of getting there, you know. And buy a barrel of pork, and you know that weighs 200 pounds. If we didn't have enough meat, he'd buy a barrel of pork. He was working on a section for $1.10 a day, 10 hours a day, pumping that damn old handcart. But Mother, she was out picking cranberries, you know. She picked, I don't know how many sacks of cranberries, gunny sacks full of cranberries. She must have picked about a half a dozen of them or more.
She'd put them up for the winter, huh?
No. She had so many that Father had to get a fellow to haul them down to Deerwood and sent them to Brainerd and sold them.
Oh, it stopped.
And that was the first suit I ever had that was bought.
From bought the cranberries?
Bought from them cranberries that Mother picked. And they didn't know nothing about agriculture. Yes, they wanted a piece of ground, and they took care of it, good care of it, and they know what kind of plants they wanted to plant, and planted in there.
He'd been a miner.
Mm-hmm. He worked in the old country. He worked with a surveyor. He was good in the woods. Did you come to that where John and I put all those spiral spikes through the...
You should really write a whole book, you know. You have such a marvelous memory.
Yeah.
You go on with the rest of your life, write an autobiography, you know.
You see, My father-in-law, he thought that he was related to the king, in, some king way back in Sweden. He was one of them kind. They kind of, they always, he was from Stockholm.
Mm.
And the first time I saw my wife, the first time I saw her, I was 34 years old. Well, I wasn't 34 then. I was about, no, I was 30, I was 32. First time I saw her, I said, there's my wife. I was finicky about how the girls dressed, you know. I like to see them neat and mm-hmm. clean, and I like to see good manners, see,
mm-hmm.
because we was taught that. You know, when we us kids grew up, we never took any of each other's things, never. If you had a different shirt, if I had a different shirt, than if my brother had a different shirt than I had, I never would go and take his shirt because I liked it.
Mm-hmm.
But some of my kids, I know, my oldest daughter, they're all good, you know. But the Frances is a little different. She's more aggressive, you know, and possessive.
Mm-hmm.
She's possessive. And Irina make a dress. And they're all good seamstresses. They do any darn thing around the house, you know, make their own mm-hmm. clothes or anything. And Irene will have a nice dress made, you know, and then Frances, and she like, oh my, what a pretty dress! let me wear it the first time, will you?
Mm-hmm.
And she'll go to maybe go to a party and take Irene's first dress, you know, and then go on show off first, you know. Well, I put a stop to that.
You mean she was so neat that you, was that the only thing you saw in her?
No, she was neat. They were all neat.
I mean your wife. How did wife?
She was pleasant talking, but there was nothing in the political line that came in, because this is many years ago. This was in 1907. See? Mm. In 1907. And she was a good worker, and she was neat and pleasant, you know, and she liked fun, you know, mm-hmm. Well, she belonged to the church and one thing and another. And of course, I had my doubts about a lot of things in the church.
Well, when you were 34, did you have any social understanding even then?
Oh, yeah, well, sure I did. Now we're coming right down to where the brass tacks begin. And this was long before I had ever been to Aiken. That's our next town.
Mm-hmm.
There was a preacher they called Hostogger. Now, the kids' ways among us children, you know, was that you behave yourself. Don't start anything. See? Mm-hmm. Like a rumpus, of any kind.
Mm-hmm.
And when you done anything, and you was, if you told a fib, you never intended to tell a fib, but it just struck you as right to say it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was the switch. That was not
a switch, not a sin.
Yeah.
And who was this preacher?
Well, this here preacher, his name was, let's see now, Krokstad. Norwegian preacher.
Mm-hmm.
And Harry Patterson got him down here. He was a Lutheran. And father says to mother, he says, I'll take Frank along. I heard him say it. And I was 8 years old, you know, a kid that age.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just learning, there was a fellow by the name of Dan, I don't know what his last name was, but they called him Dan all the time, that worked in the woods, and he stayed at our house when we had jumped, I claim, when we were squatting. And he taught me the ABCs in English. And when we got in the log cabin, I never saw him anymore. Then mother taught me the ABCs in Swedish, see? And I'd learned that at her, I'd stand on my knees and she'd have the book right down on her knee, you know. Then they had a stick. It was like this. And then it come down to a point, a long one, like this, you know. a pointer. And she'd hold it like that, you know, in her fingers. And she'd hold it right on the word that she said, so I wouldn't make it and get mixed up on the words, you know. Well, I learned the ABCs all right. Then we got a Swedish paper from St. Paul. A Swedish paper from St. Paul called Skaffel, come once a week. And in those days they didn't advertise, or they might, I saw Curico advertised it in it. But there was no commercial advertising to a great extent in those papers in those days, you know. Everything was news, or a discourse on religion and something like that, because they never left. They always had that poison in there, you know. So we were reading that. Well, I was 10 years old. And we got had an agent in Deerwood, the first agent, depot agent. His name was Wheeler. And father had been down to the depot, and that's where they used to hold the first elections in the depot. You know, and they'd send them down 2 3-gallon jugs of liquor and a couple of boxes of cigar to swing the vote, you know. And then there'd be maybe a big quarrel, you know, when they got to drinking, they might say something that was so palatable to the rest of them.
I'm going to move this because it's going to be ticking on the tape. Yeah, so what?
And then, where was I now?
This minister and this Wheeler.
Oh, yeah. But I believe this minister was first. I got to take him first because he was first. Wheeler came after. But anyway, father said, I'm going to take Frank along. He says, thought I needed a little religion, I suppose, so take me along. And we held a meeting in the section house. I don't know how he got there. He might have got there on a handcar like my father. Doctor did. Now, anyway, he was going to preach. And he preached hell and damnation and brimstone, you know, the whole preach. You know, these were a whole lot of ignoramuses, all of them, including my father and mother and all the neighbors that was around. Crone wasn't here, by golly, then. Crone wasn't here, John Brand, no.
He hadn't come yet.
They hadn't come yet, no. I think it was just Patterson and their section crew and father and I.
He's the only white people in this.
Only white people. And he preached that, and you know, that night when I came home, I couldn't sleep. I was thinking about the hellfire, you know, and brimstone. Oh, he was a terrible preacher, the worst one I ever heard. And I didn't know at the time, but I realized afterward, was to keep all these greenhorns, you know, in check, that they didn't go and do something vicious because they'd be punished, you know. Well, that went on. I dreamt about it all night. I couldn't sleep. I'd wake up. Just as soon as I shut my eyes, I would dream about that. I was scared stiff. I began thinking about this here. And then mother, she had a catechism. Swedish Catechism of the Lutheran Church, and we had to learn to read from the Catechism. That's why she taught me the Swedish letters.
See? That's a frightening thing too.
Yeah.
That Catechism, I've seen it.
Yeah, but I was confirmed though. I went through the middle right.
Yeah.
I was the ringleader of the Young People Society here in the church when they built the church.
Mm-hmm.
I meant business.
You were going to keep out of hell, I bet.
Well, not good. I didn't believe in that, you know. But then at the same time, I thought it was all right that people were warned against what is wrong, you know. I never want to tell anybody a lie. I never lied to anybody. I don't remember once that I lied to anybody. And then I became, then I got interested, the reason that the milk came in there was because I had to carry 1 quart of milk from the farm in the winter time, 10 years old, and there was no road down to a wheeler, and when I got there, the pail was froze solid, and then he take it and put it on a pot-bellied stove there and thaw it out and empty it and clean the pail and hand me a nickel in the pail.
How far was that?
That's a mile and a half from the farmhouse.
Do you have to go in the evening after milking?
No, when went in the morning. Oh, that would have been dangerous. And coyotes and wolves and bears and deer and every other doggone thing around, you know, you couldn't. We did. The wolves would howl and we'd skip for the house.
Mm-hmm. So how did you get away from this hellfire?
Oh, I got away from that, I'll tell you.
That's a terrible thing for children, I think, that awful.
Oh, terrible.
Hellfire.
And so, when I got into catechism, you know, then Mother began to talk about God's love for children and God's love for humanity and all that, you know. And then I had all of this, I heard this here preacher. And of course they believed in the hereafter, see. And so she told me about, well, Mother, I says, Emily, you'll be there in that hellfire forever, you know. But I said, no, I says, I argued with her. I didn't believe that. Because I says, you love me, and if I fell in the fire, you'd be right there to pull me out. I says, how can God have a little boy or a man or a woman in hellfire forever? See?
Mm-hmm.
So we disagreed. Well, then it came. Then Father was reading. We had a table just about this size, this table that he had made. Victor made this one. But he had a table about this here size. And when we and that was shoved up against the window. And there was only three of us at the table. I'd be sitting on that end, and John was sitting on that end, and Father was sitting on this side. And Mother would wait on us, you know. She had the rest of the kids to wait on, too. So she, I remember, we were sitting there, and then after everything was cleaned off the table after dinner, well, then the Father used to pull the table out on the floor away from the window, and he'd take a chair and sit down with his back towards the window on account of the light. You see, it had a big window, nine panes in it, and 10 by 12 panes in there. The panes were that size. And he'd laid a newspaper flat on the table, like this. And of course he'd have it right. And I was interested, because when I was carrying this here milk, I heard him tell Mother that John D. Rockefeller had just given $10,000 to some church, you know. And this happened so many times in the early days of the John D. Rockefeller oil empire. And I begin to wonder how it was that Father knew so much about that there. See?
Mm.
But he was reading it in the paper. Well, then I wanted to read the paper, learn to read the paper, see? And I stood here on this side of the table, and when Father saw me looking at the paper where he was reading, he put his finger on the words in the paper. And you know, I learned to read the paper upside down just as good as he could draw straight. So you see how ambitious
I was. You wanted to know.
I wanted to know so I could pick up the paper and tell about John D. Rockefeller when he gave money to the church. That's how I got the interest that, and I didn't think that was right. No, I didn't think that was right. Because every time he raised gave a donation to the church. He raised the kerosene 2 cents a gallon. See, I
put that together.
And I had to carry the kerosene. And when my father said, "Well, kerosene is 11 cents. You send Frank when he goes to Deerwood, give him the oil can and get some kerosene, and that's 11 cents." Well. Maybe after we heard about this here donation given to John D. Rockefeller, you know, maybe the, he give another one. And by golly, the kerosene went up, see? Every time he made a donation, the kerosene went up.
Uh-huh.
Well, that impressed me so doggone much, you know, that I thought that wasn't fair. because we couldn't get 10 cents in pennies for a year, us kids. And just think me falling and tumbling around in the snow and carrying milk for 5 cents, for 5 cents a quart. You know, that was preposterous, you know. I didn't think that was right. And then that's the way. I never in all my life had was turned on the reactionary side. I wasn't a reactionary. I didn't know much about politics. I didn't know. I was a doggone green when I was 22 years old. I was a darn green that a cow would have picked me out in the pasture for the greenest bit that she'd seen. I didn't know nothing. Absolutely nothing. I knew all about the woods and our neighbors and that and what we was doing, you know. And
you didn't leave, go to work like Victor. I mean, he went when he was 15. He left, but you stayed.
I stayed
with your mother.
I was pretty old when I went out the first time, but I was in the Dakotas in the harvest fields 11 summers. So that's where I started.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked on the railroads, and in the wintertime I'd work in the woods. And then if I made it, I could go to Dakota, and the most I ever made, I'd be there about 3 months, would be $96, and I saved every cent. And my mother says, the first time I went out, she said, "Frank," she says, "whatever you do," she says, "don't you ever touch liquor." Oh, I said, "I wouldn't do it." And I didn't. And I
so
worked
you,
in a
you
sand.
Saved, you'd get your room and board, and then you'd save every penny.
Yeah, every penny. We got to... we was always wanted. That's why I happened to go out. To they liked those dear boys. They were certainly good workers. They talked between themselves, you know. And we were, because we wanted to earn our money. We wanted that money, and we worked for it.
Mm-hmm. Would you give that all to your mother?
Oh,
then?
We wouldn't know. No.
You went to school?
Well, that didn't help. That money didn't help for the school. No, but I come home, and I remember the first time to come. I'd buy coats and clothes for the whole family.
Uh-huh.
See? And then I'd hang on to a little money. Of course, Dad thought I'd hand it all over to him, but then I know that was the last of it. And I wanted some good clothes, too. And that way I kept up till Victor, he was good, and Charlie was good. And here was another thing that was funny. Father was hard boiled. You had to work. I had worked, and this was many years afterward. I'd worked in the lumber mill in Brainerd 2 years, John and I, and when they had a big lumber mill there, and then. In 1900, we was out in the swamp called Dry Pond. It's over out here, just a little ways, making hay. I was with him, and Father and I we disagreed on how to raise cattle. You know, I wanted to improve the stock, and Dad didn't care. See, I wanted a good sire, and he didn't care what kind of a sire you had when you bred your cows. And I was serious. I meant business. Doggone, by golly, father wouldn't, because I saw that it didn't make any difference how hard you worked if you didn't try to improve the conditions of your stock and improve your stock that you were left behind, because I happened to see some good cattle.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted cattle like that, and I want to breed up to them. No, he objected. And mother, she was raking hay. Albertine was out working. John was gone working. And Victor, I think he was home. Victor was home. And Charlie, yeah, he was home too. So Father and I got into an argument in the middle. And I took the fork I had and stuck it in the ground. And I said, if that's the way you want to farm, I said, I'm going to leave. And I left right there. I didn't have I had some money, but it was a little. You'll soon find out how much I had. I went home.
You just started walking.
I went home and told my sister, Mary, and she was an awful good kid. And she went and told her I was going to Minneapolis. I had enough so I could buy a ticket from Deerwood to Brainerd. I just want to put everybody off the track, you know. I bought a ticket to Brainerd. I think that was 49 cents or something like that. And my sister went with me. No, Charlie and Victor were home, and Mary was home. Johnny, he was working for a fellow by the name of Johnson at Jonesville. And so Mary went with me, and she was crying because I was leaving. I told her I was leaving, but I said, I'm going to write home so you'll hear from me. I'm going to Minneapolis. So when I came to Brainerd, I walked from Brainerd to Jonesville, I think the name of the next town below me, is about 10 miles. Walked down there. And I hadn't had nothing to eat neither, you see, except for breakfast. And so I thought, I'll go into one of these here farmhouses, because I had no compunction about that, because that was general rule here. If you went to a farm, and it was always a lunch, you know. So I went in there, and an old lady came up to the house, and I told her I was on my way to Minneapolis, and I said I ain't got more money than a little money to get into Minneapolis, and if I could have a slice of bread and some milk. And she did. She put up two slices of bread and a big bowl of milk, you know. And I thanked her for it. I told her I didn't have any money. I was a young fellow, and looked like a kid, you know. And while I was eating that lunch, I heard a train coming from Brainerd. And he stopped at Jonesville, see. And I hustled up and drank my milk, and took my bread in the hand, ran out there, and jumped into an empty boxcar. I was going to ride to Minneapolis. But then I'd heard what they do with the hobos, you know, when they get into Minneapolis, they grab them outside there, not at Anoka, but what do you call that station on this side of Minneapolis now? Well, anyways, before you enter the city of Minneapolis, that didn't grab you. So I figured that I'd ride that far and I'd go to Anoka. I'd go to Anoka and I'd get off the train, and I did, got off the train. And I just had enough money so I could get a ticket into Minneapolis. And I had one penny left, see. This was in the afternoon. And I went up to 20th Avenue North on Washington. Went up to 20th Avenue and there was three sawmills down there. But I didn't go there to them sawmills the first thing. The first thing I want something to eat. You know, a young kid, you know, he gets hungry. And I told him, I said, of course, I didn't know anything about city life. I didn't know a thing about it. I said, have you got anything I can do to get a meal? Oh, by golly, they all refused. I didn't get it. And it was getting dark in the evening. So I went down to 20th Avenue in Washington. On the corner there was a policeman standing there. And I says to the policeman, I told him my experience from home, you know. He says, my boy, he says, you're no bum. He says, you come along with me. And he took me into a restaurant and he said, you give this fellow a good meal. And then he says, and then you come here in the morning and get a meal. Now he says, I haven't got no, we haven't got no room. He says, but I'll give you a good bed at the police station. And so he took, and it was not in a cell or anything like that. It was right in the open, you know. He had a good steel bed there, iron bed, and mattress in it, you know. Give me a couple of looked like army blankets, you know. And I slept there, and he come there and woke me up in the morning. And I went down to, after I got my supper, no, before, I told the policeman about that. I went down to the Akeley Lumber Company, and when I just about got to the office, I met a fella. And I asked him who he was, and he was one of the foremen in the, or one of the supervisors there in the Akeley Lumber Company. And I told him my story, you know, what I had done and how I happened to be there and all about it, you know. And he says, yes, he says, you come down here in the morning, he says, and I'll give you a job. So I went back up there, and I told the policeman about this. And I never saw that policeman again. I never spotted him, didn't never missed him. But he was certainly a good fellow to recognize. And when I got through with breakfast, I went down there to the Cliff Sawmill, and the first fellow I met was, his name was Dahlquist.
What a memory.
And he says to me, I'm ashamed, he says, to meet you this morning. I says, why, you don't have anything to be ashamed of. Yes, he says, because I didn't give you a couple of dollars, he says, so that you could find the place. And then I told him what this policeman had done, you know.
He thought about it all
yeah,
night, eh?
Yeah. And by golly, you know, he was awfully good to me, and I worked for him for 2 years.
Yeah. When did you first hear about socialism?
Well, I want to tell you about that. I went, I was in Duluth. Let's see now. I was in Duluth in 1895. And I worked on the, I was a scraper on the cars of the ore docks. You know, if I had anything to say, I said it. Because I felt that was my right, you know. I had used no compunction. I didn't care who he was or who they were, you know. If I had something to say, I'd say it. Whether it was pertinent or not, you know, I didn't care about that. I wanted information. I wanted to know why and wherefore and all this and that, you know, about everything. So you had a long handle shovel, you know, and you scraped the cars. The cars were made out of wood then, and there was a sill all around the car about that wide. And when they loaded it with a shovel, with a steam shovel, why, they'd spill ore on the ore car, spill on this ledge, you know. And then there was two of us that had, there was an awful lot of ore came in Duluth then. And we, of course, there are more now. But we had to go and scrape off all that ore. We didn't have to put it in there. If it fell on the ground, why, it'd just go down in the pocket, you know. And couple of fellows that done the wrenching that locked the, there's a trap door under in every car that you open up when you empty it, you see, mm-hmm. over the pocket. And there was two big fellows that was doing that work. They had a long wrench, that was about 6 foot long, big jaw on it like that, and there was great big nuts on there to turn, you know, and lock that. It ain't like it is now, mm. that everything is done automatic.
I've seen that.
And they were quite talkative, and they were Scandinavians, see?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I talk pretty good English, and they talk, so we talk English all the time. And they, sometimes they bring up a question, and we were at loggerheads, see? Right? They'd hold their point, and I held my view. Well, somebody must have listened to us. Because there was a fellow that was foreman, his name was Johnson, and I had no more respect for him than I had for anybody else. So if I was talking to somebody, that didn't seem to bother me any. I just kept on talking whether the boss came by or not, you know. And he says, I'll tell you, Frank, he says, what you ought to do. He says, you ought to go down on Snuff Corner on Superior Street. He said, that's 20th Avenue West.
Snuff Corner.
He called it a snooze her nut.
A snoozing.
Snooze her nut. That's the Snuff Corner. You'll hear a fella there. You'll hear a fella there. He said, I think, he said, you'll like him. And he was no socialist, this guy.
Mm-hmm.
He was just a common, ordinary individual, and he was a good deal on the selfish order. But he thought he was kidding me, you know. See? Well, I took it for granted, by golly, that's where I was going. So I went down there. I was a little bit late. There was a fellow standing on a soapbox on the street right on the corner, talking. And his name was Karl Kritz. He was a German. And he worked at the Clyde Ironworks there in Duluth. And by golly, I took to it just like ducks to water. He was a socialist, see? He was a socialist. And I bought all the literature that he had, you know. I was going to read up on this stuff because if it could pertain to what he said, by God, it was interest to me. And my very nature was right in that line, you know. That's the way I felt about mm-hmm. things. And by golly, it wasn't long before a policeman come and grabbed him and took him off to jail. I said, what's the matter with him? What crime has he committed? Well, he no crime. But they don't allow him to talk on the street. That was all the crime there was. They don't allow him to talk on the street. Well, I said, he was telling the truth. I can't see why he couldn't tell the truth. Well, that didn't make any difference. His name was Karl Kritz, a little short fellow. And just as the policeman got out of sight, another fellow stepped on there. His name was Louis Dvorak. He was a helper for Carl Thiel, a photographer. He was helper for him. And he got up and spoke. He spoke about 5 minutes, and another policeman come and grabbed him. And then I bought every damn gun thing they had, you know, in literature, all kinds of, all the variety, everything they had around there. Commenced studying the thing. And
did you commence to talk to?
Oh yeah, sure. Tell you what I did. I came home, I was so full of socialism. Then I went and got a big tablet like I had, and I wrote notices on there, and I went out to the school board in Irondale Township and asked for the use of the schoolhouse for a meeting. And I'd been, before that, I'd been up on the, up on section 22, there was Antoninus, Nigrin, and Albert Jacobson, and Pisk. They call it on section 22, that's up between here and Brainerd. They were clustered together right in the middle of the section. And I got in an argument with them, and of course they got mad, you know. They got mad about something because they didn't know. I didn't, but I had the principle right. I thought that the workers should have something to say about things, you know. And, and my father, he was politically minded, but he didn't know anything about economics. All he knew enough to put him on the edge so that if it was wrong, he wouldn't do it, you know. They tried to sell a stud horse here, $1,500 for a stud horse. And Kaufman and father were the only ones that didn't take stock in that stud horse, and he wasn't worth a dime. So things like deeds like that, that's something they knew about, you know, they didn't stick up for the right thing. And when Brainerd gave $200,000, the county gave $200,000 to the lumber company that put the sawmill in Brainerd because they wanted the help. Now, that's just exactly what Freeman is doing, dishing out a lot of money for fellows that... why should we pay a bonus to a business enterprise coming into your town? You never saw one yet, but what, he went out with all the money you had. See? Well, that's what they did. And they said, that'll last for your sons and your grandsons. And the mill has been gone many years back. All the timber's skinned, you know. Now they're buying it up. Now they're buying it up by the hundreds and thousands of acres for these paper companies. Cloquet Paper Company and the Brainerd Paper Company are all amalgamated, you know, into one big company. And they're buying out the fairground in Brainerd. And they got to move the fairground to some other place now.